Coming up, tens of thousands of unaccompanied migrant children await court action on their fate. Kim Lawton looks at religious efforts to help them through the legal process. And Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports that the Chinese government, long hostile to religion, may now be encouraging Buddhism and other traditional religions as a means toward protecting the environment. Plus, rebuilding St. Nicholas Church at Ground Zero, the only house of worship destroyed on 9/11.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, the World Health Organization, WHO, said the Ebola death toll has risen to over 4,800 people worldwide. Most infections have been in West Africa, where hospital beds and food are in short supply. In Liberia, Doctors Without Borders delivered thousands of medical kits to families forced to care for their infected relatives at home. Meanwhile, continued concerns here in the U.S. as a New York City doctor became the city's first person to test positive for Ebola. Dr. Craig Spencer had recently returned from Guinea, where he'd been working with Doctors Without Borders. Heavy fighting continued in Syria as Kurdish forces sought to defend the border town of Kobani from ISIS. The U.S. led a series of airstrikes against ISIS and attempted to drop supplies for the Kurdish fighters. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned that a purely military response in Syria without a political solution could lead to more extremism. The Vatican issued a similar caution, urging governments to go beyond military action and increase humanitarian aid to refugees. U.S. Cardinal Raymond Burke confirmed that he'll be removed from his position as Chief Justice of the Vatican Supreme Court. Burke is known for his outspoken conservative views on a number of issues, including same-sex marriage. Last week, he criticized a Vatican meeting of bishops that had considered adopting more welcoming language toward gays and divorced Catholics. The meeting ended without a clear consensus, but the issue will continue to be debated ahead of a follow-up meeting next year. An emotional homecoming this week for the family of American Jeffrey Fowle, who was released after spending 5 months as a prisoner in North Korea. While visiting there, the 56-year-old Fowle was arrested for leaving a Bible in a sailor's club, which the country said was illegal. The U.S. called on North Korea to release two other Americans still imprisoned there, Matthew Miller and Christian missionary Kenneth Bay. Now, a special report. Tens of thousands of migrant children, largely from Central America, have flooded into the U.S. over the past year in a surge that culminated this summer. They're now awaiting court decisions about whether they should be deported. Kim Lawton looks at how people of faith are trying to help the children through the complicated legal process, even as the nation continues to debate whether or not they should be sent back.
In suburban Maryland, teenage siblings Henry and Karen Castellanos are taking a walk with their uncle and two young cousins. It's a world away from their former lives in El Salvador, where violent gangs so terrorized their community, people were afraid to leave their homes.
They start killing in front of our house, and every day it was getting worse.
Henry says gang members followed him everywhere, making threats and trying to force him to join them. One of Karen's close friends was raped. The situation became so desperate that in March 2012, their parents decided to send them to the U.S., unaccompanied, to be with their uncle. Henry was 16, Karen 14.
Actually, my whole family decided that it will be a better future for us to travel to the United States.
Their father paid a smuggler, known as a coyote, to take them on a perilous 4-month-long journey through El Salvador and Mexico and into the U.S. Sometimes they rode in cars, but often they walked through the desert.
¿En el desierto?
In the desert, we ran into wolves, a snake. We walked for 3 nights, and I remember that the last night, I didn't think I could walk anymore because we walked from 6 at night to 6 in the morning.
I just woke up all sweaty and remember all those times that I was sleeping outside in the coldness. Remember my family and trying to keep myself together.
Castellanos came at the beginning of an unprecedented surge of unaccompanied minors coming largely from the violence-stricken nations of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. From October 2013 to August 2014, more than 65,000 migrant children entered the U.S. and now await court action on their fate. Some people of faith are trying to help them through the complicated legal process.
A nation should be judged on how it treats children.
Looming in the background is an intense national debate over whether the unaccompanied minors ultimately should be sent home.
What we should do with people who are already here is reunite them with their parents in the countries they come from.
Under a 2008 law designed to protect victims of trafficking, unaccompanied minors entering the U.S. who are not from Mexico or Canada are not immediately returned to their country of origin. Instead, they're granted a legal hearing. They may apply for special immigrant juvenile status or for asylum if they claim to be fleeing persecution. The unprecedented number of children from Central America is overwhelming this process. New York Law School professor Lenny Benson is director of the Safe Passage Project, a group that recruits and trains pro bono attorneys to represent immigrant youth. She says because immigration proceedings are not criminal proceedings, the U.S. government is not required to provide free counsel.
The law is so technical and complex that for a child to navigate its corridors without an attorney, it's impossible. The impact of not having an attorney is the difference between being able to stay in the country and become a lawful resident and being deported or living undocumented.
The government has been trying to expedite the process by fast-tracking the child migrant cases through what's known as a rocket docket. Even so, the fastest cases will likely take at least a year, maybe two, before they're resolved. This has strained many legal resources and compounded the need for attorneys willing to take on the cases. Several religious groups have been trying to provide legal help for children like Henry and Karen, who were apprehended soon after they crossed the U.S. border. They were separated for weeks before they were sent to live with their uncle in Maryland and began attending school. They received legal representation through Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Washington.
Catholic Charities' purpose is to help people who are disempowered, and this is one population that is.
Attorney Jennifer Bibby Girth says Catholic Charities is having a tough time keeping up with the demand.
We refer people to private attorneys if we can't take the case, but now we're being told that all the private attorneys on our list are full.
Many local congregations are also offering support, including Bibby Girth's parish, St. Camillus Catholic Church in Silver Spring. She says volunteers can drive children to court hearings and legal appointments or help with Spanish translation. Psychologists and mental health professionals can help with evaluation and counseling. After Mass on this Sunday, interested church members gathered to hear more.
Who are these children and why were they coming?
Many people of faith see aiding migrant children as a religious imperative.
From a Christian perspective, but I think it's also true in many other faiths, we're called to love and serve our neighbor. Not the neighbor that we choose, but the neighbors that God gives to us.
Lenny Benson's grandmother was an unaccompanied child who fled religious persecution in Russia. She says her immigration work comes out of her Jewish faith and the numerous commands in Scripture to protect the stranger in your land.
This rhetoric of how do you treat the stranger in a land? How do you embrace those who need assistance? The more you study it, the more you see every world religion has this tenet of being hospitable to those who are in need, who come to you and ask for assistance.
But not all people of faith agree that the best way to help migrant children is to let them stay in the U.S. permanently. Jim Robb is a vice president at Numbers USA, an advocacy group that tries to reduce illegal immigration numbers.
We need to use the immigration laws and even tighten them up so that people will understand that when you come here, if you're not legal and you don't have a legitimate political claim or religious claim, you're going to be sent back immediately.
Robb is also a lay leader at his Anglican church. He says while he supports scriptural mandates to help others, he believes that should be balanced with verses demanding justice.
When does mercy given to one cause a lack of mercy? When is it being unmerciful to someone else? If we have a group that comes in, a large group, and they begin to receive resources, that means other people are going to have to, in the end, have less resources.
Benson argues that the U.S. must continue its tradition as an international advocate of human rights and liberty.
The question for our government will be, even if they have deportation orders, is it ethical and legal to remove a child to a country of origin if we aren't assured that that child will be safe upon return?
Robb worries that allowing them to ultimately stay will encourage even more people to attempt the dangerous journey.
We're giving the impression to millions of people that it's okay to come, and when you come, there'll be everything will be provided. There'll be a job. You'll be reunited with whoever you know here, and that's a cruel thing to do.
Still others say it would be cruel to send them home.
No child who expresses credible fear for their life if they're returned to their country of origin should be forced back.
More than 2 years after they arrived, Henry and Karen Castellanos have been approved for special immigrant juvenile status and can apply for a green card. Although they miss their family in El Salvador, they're dreaming about a new future.
I want to finish a school and be a doctor or maybe a teacher.
I don't feel afraid anymore for someone to try to kill me or do something. Now I can go to school. And I'm learning. I might think that I have a better future.
They say they're glad they made it, but wouldn't want anyone else to go through what they did to get here. I'm Kim Lawton in Silver Spring, Maryland.
For several years, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been using its website to explain some of its misunderstood practices. The latest effort is a 4-minute video about Mormons' sacred undergarments. It likens them to Judaism's prayer shawls, Islamic skull caps, or the saffron robes of Buddhist monks, insisting there is nothing magical or mystical about the two-piece white undergarments. They are, says the video, signs of Mormons' relationship to God and their commitment to living good lives. We have a story today from Fred DeSam Lazaro in Beijing about signs that the Chinese government is easing some of its hostility to religion. The reason is the finding of environmentalists who say Buddhism and other Chinese traditions emphasize values that can help reduce pollution. Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and Face-to-Face Media.
On the 20th floor of a Beijing high-rise, one of China's senior environmental reporters is becoming a Buddhist. Liu Zhenchong is an investigative journalist. His first story about the environment was an exposé about illegal dam construction on the upper Yangtze River. It made national headlines. His hard-hitting stories eventually got him fired, so he continued his work at China Dialogue, an international online journal. After 10 years of reporting, he says, he was feeling burned out.
Every day, what we do are good deeds, which may give us positive energy. But meanwhile, what we are facing is the darkest side of the world. As an environmentalist, every day what we see is polluted air, polluted rivers, and the slaughter of wild animals. This kind of negative energy attacks us every day. Where do we draw our strength from?
Liu Jiancheng is one of millions of Chinese who are returning to Buddhist, Taoist, and Confucian temples that were once condemned by the government.
A little more than four decades ago, during China's Cultural Revolution, many Buddhist temples, like this one in central Beijing, were destroyed or defaced. Today, these temples are alive with worshippers. By some accounts, one out of every five Chinese call themselves Buddhist.
Some scholars say this search for faith is linked to China's massive environmental problems.
In a world in which capitalism and socialism and consumerism have created a kind of industrial behemoth that is just thundering ahead, that is draining life out of the villages, that is polluting the soil and the air and the water, you have a heartless world.
But you mentioned that I've translated both the Laozi and Zhuangzi.
Martin Palmer, shown in a Chinese TV broadcast here, is based in the UK but has been working in China for nearly 20 years, urging religious groups to respond to this crisis and to encourage conservation. In 2006, he realized this message was also being heard by the Communist Party.
I was called in for a meeting in 2006 with the Minister for the Environment, Minister for Religion, and they were very frank. They said the single child policy has created the most selfish generation in China's history because each child has been brought up as the center of absolute devotion by the family. Nothing is too much to give to them. And these two Communist Party officials said, we want the religions to help us bring compassion back.
But what is it that finally persuades an individual like Liu Jiancheng to cross the gap from atheism to Buddhism, in his case, the smaller Tibetan branch, which has about 5 million adherents? Shirley Hong is a journalist and filmmaker. She's known Liu for more than 10 years, but she was still surprised by his decision.
When I learned that Jiancheng was converted, I was really shocked. You know, our generation, like, we have been raised as atheist through childhood. We were taught that, you know, all religious beliefs are, you know, superstitious. So it's very hard for me to believe in any religion. I feel there's a huge gap. So I was very curious, you know, I want to know what has made him to cross that gap. So I, you know, start to think my other friends who was converted to Buddhism.
To satisfy her curiosity, she took a film crew to the highlands of Western China, an area adjoining the autonomous region more commonly known outside China as Tibet. It's rich in biodiversity that conservation groups say is greatly imperiled. This is also home to the headwaters of the Yellow and Yangtze rivers, quite literally a lifeline to hundreds of millions of people downstream. A prominent person in her documentary is a monk named Tashi Sange. He explains how conservation and respect for all living things has long been an intrinsic part of life here.
My grandmother taught me that I shouldn't wash my hands or pee in the river or make it dirty. I said, why? They told me there is a dragon god. I asked them what the dragon god looks like, and they said, don't say it, don't say it. Mama and Papa told me in secret that this is a sacred lake, but they said, don't ever talk about it openly, because we couldn't talk about gods. They do not exist in the Communist Party's eyes. They are superstitions. If anyone talked about a god, they would be beaten, so we wouldn't dare to say it.
But through thick and thin in a country that's seen so much political upheaval and social change, those fundamental values have endured, he says.
Who will protect the environment? In the West and in China, it's the government's responsibility. But the Tibetans don't think this way. This is not the Buddhist way. If you think that way, you are not a Buddhist. You are the protector. No matter if you are a newborn or an 80-year-old, you are all protectors. You are all responsible, and you have the responsibility. All life should be protected.
Back in China's capital, Liu Jiancheng, guided by the Tibetan monk Chame Rinpoche, says his spiritual journey has changed the way he sees the world and his whole approach to writing.
Before, I only wrote from a legal point of view. It's wrong, this is a national park, and how can you destroy it? Now when I write, in my mind, what I think is they are fishes. They are millions of lives. When I write this way, I think that I should speak on their behalf. I shouldn't just think of what is good for us, what's good for humans. I can clearly see the change in me.
China's omnipresent and officially atheist Communist Party appears to be actively supporting traditional culture, as one official called it, at this recent gathering. The former Communist Party Central Committee member said, ecologically sustainable civilization begins with simple concepts.
What we think in our hearts and minds will determine the state of the environment. Traditional Chinese culture promotes harmony between man and nature and encourages limited consumption and a simple way of life. We support this. We don't oppose taking from nature. We do oppose over-exploitation. We want Gold Mountain, but we also want clear water and Green Mountain.
My sense is that this partnership between religion and the government around environment is only going to get stronger and stronger.
A partnership that he hopes will help lower the heavy environmental price China is paying for its economic progress of recent decades. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSanlazaro.
On our calendar this week, Hindus, Sikhs, and Jains began their 5-day celebration of Diwali, the Festival of Lights. Also, Protestants observe Reformation Sunday, which commemorates the day in 1517 when tradition says Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to a church door in Wittenberg, Germany. Friday is All Hallows Eve, Halloween, followed by All Saints Day on Saturday, honoring saints and martyrs. Finally, St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church at Ground Zero in New York was the only house of worship destroyed in the attacks of 9/11. Now, 13 years later, church officials have broken ground to rebuild. Kim Lawton has more.
We ask God's glory.
With prayers and celebration, leaders of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America dedicated the site of the future St. Nicholas National Shrine at the World Trade Center. It will overlook the new 9/11 memorial. The St. Nicholas Parish was established by Greek immigrants in 1916. In 2001, about 70 families worshiped there, and many Orthodox and non-Orthodox workers from the Wall Street area would come during the week to pray. When the towers fell on 9/11, the tiny church was crushed. Only a few remnants were dug out of the rubble, two torn icons, a charred Bible, and some liturgical items, including a twisted candelabra.
It really felt like we were losing a member of our community, and it was something that, as we've struggled to deal with it and we've struggled to mourn St. Nicholas, it's something that today we're also very pleased and very grateful to be here to start the rebuilding process.
It's been a long time coming. For years, rebuilding plans were delayed because of a legal dispute between church officials and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which has overseen all rebuilding at Ground Zero. Under a negotiated agreement, the new St. Nicholas will be on a larger site just a short distance from its original location. The $38 million rebuild was designed by prominent Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava. So far, the Archdiocese has raised $7 million for the project. Along with serving as a regular Greek Orthodox parish, the new St. Nicholas will include a non-denominational area intended to be a place of pilgrimage for those coming to the 9/11 memorial.
But as a center for bereavement, for comfort, for prayer, for meditation, for quietness in the midst of any turbulence of life.
Church officials hope the shrine can be a witness to people of all faiths about the enduring power of hope, even in the midst of unspeakable tragedy.
Next to the place where the most tragic thing that has ever happened on American soil happened, it needs to be a place to offer, to welcome, to open and to accept all sorts of people.
The new St. Nicholas is expected to be completed in 2 years, just in time for the parish's 100th anniversary. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, including more about unaccompanied migrant children. You can also listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from this week's Beatification Mass for Pope Paul VI at the Vatican.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.